Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, welcome to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. In the last one, you heard me talking to Lindsay and Gabby from the All Ears English Podcast. We were talking about our culture shock experiences as a general sort of look at what culture shock is and how we can understand it. You heard me in that episode say that I would go into a little bit more detail regarding the different stages or phases of culture shock. So that's what I'd like to do in this episode. First of all, why am I talking about culture shock so much? In fact, I've got lots and lots of things to say on this subject. It's something that comes up on Luke's English Podcast sometimes. I did an episode called Sick in Japan, where I described a story about how I got sick while living in Japan, but that kind of included lots of culture shock experiences. I did another episode called First Impressions of Life in Paris, which is all about, well, clearly my first impressions of living in Paris. And now I'm revisiting the subject in a bit more depth in order to really kind of clarify lots of the different issues that relate to this. I think it's a really good subject to deal with on the podcast because, of course, I have people listening to this from all around the world. In fact, if I have a look now at the statistics on my website, let me just have a little look here and we can see who's listening or who's at least visiting the web page. If I have a look at the statistics for yesterday, I'll be able to see who which are the top countries. Okay, so yesterday the top country was Russia, the Russian Federation, after that Poland, then Spain, then Italy, then the United Kingdom, then Japan, then Ukraine, United States, Republic of Korea, I think that's South Korea, I don't have the full name there, it's basically South Korea, Brazil, Czech Republic, Belarus, Mexico, those are the top countries by visits to my website. So obviously Luke's English Podcast is a massive, oh yes, it's a big international community, okay? And so I expect that you, the people listening to this, will have some kind of culture shock experience in your life. Either you are living in a foreign country, you might be living in the UK, for example, and you're experiencing some level of culture shock on a daily basis, just trying to get used to life in Britain and the weather and the food and understanding the weird ways in which we do things. So either you're living in an English-speaking country like perhaps England, in the UK, or you are someone who has spent time living abroad. You might have travelled abroad to work and lived for, you know, a fairly long period of time. You may have lived in the UK and now you're back in your own country just trying to keep your English fresh. Or maybe you're someone who's never been anywhere. You've only ever stayed in your country. You've never had the opportunity to go abroad, but you'd love to. And one day you plan to do it. Or maybe you've actually got specific plans to go and stay somewhere. You could be, for example, planning a trip to London where you're going to stay for a few months and learn English. Lots of possibilities. But I imagine that almost all of you will or will have had all kinds of different cross-cultural experiences. This is the community of Luke's English Podcast. That's why I think it's really important to cover this subject, because culture shock is something that everyone experiences. It's not necessarily something that everyone is ready to experience or something that we're all prepared for. I think the name culture shock, the word, is a little bit misleading, because culture shock, that suggests that what will happen is you'll step off the aeroplane or step out of the train station into this new country that you're visiting, and you expect to have a kind of slap in the face. It's not normally like that unless you go to somewhere really different. I mean, I've been to India a couple of times, and I did find it to be a little bit of a shock when I arrived. Obviously, it's a beautiful, fantastic country, but it's really quite different to life in England. For example, you get out of the airport and immediately you're confronted with a much more chaotic environment than I'm used to in England. So that was quite a shock, because it's like, wow, lots of people are trying to talk to me. Everyone's trying to get my attention because they want me to use their taxi. I don't know who to trust. Are these people real taxi drivers, or are they going to try and take me somewhere where I don't want to go? It's really confusing and chaotic. So that's quite a shocking scenario at the beginning. But I think most of the time when you go somewhere, it's not really a shock. And culture shock doesn't, you don't experience culture shock in the way that you might expect. In fact, the symptoms of culture shock may be hard even to identify. Sometimes it happens without you even realizing it. And I'll be going into that in a bit more detail. So culture shock is real. It's definitely something that happens. It just might not happen in the way that you expect it to. First of all, before I start talking about the four phases of culture shock, let's just make sure we know what it is. Of course, it's the disorientation that a person might feel when they go to a different culture. It could be going to another country, but it could just be when they experience a change in culture in another context. For example, it could be when you go and work in a different company, a company that has a different, you know, company culture. It could also be when you go to another part of your country where they do things a little bit differently. You can experience culture shock in that situation too. So it's not just an international thing. It's it can be a local thing. It can be kind of quite a small thing, like going to a new company. There's lots of ways that you can experience it. So it's ultimately it's a question of change management, or the way in which you respond or react to living in a different environment, okay? How you cope with a change of environment and an unfamiliar lifestyle. Culture shock can manifest itself in terms of behavior, like just the general way in which people behave in this new place. It could be the values held by the people in this new place, the fact that they, as a general rule in that culture, think that certain aspects of life are more important than others, and that sort of comes through in various ways, and you start to realize, wow, these people think this is very important. Like, for example, in France, one of the values that they have is that they enjoy taking pleasure from having some food. It's very important. So that means, for example, that at lunchtime they take, it can be 2 hours between 12 o'clock and 2 o'clock. Within those 2 hours, most people are basically just trying to enjoy their lunch, and they take time over it, and that's normal, because eating and enjoying food is a very important part of the culture. So what that means for me is that if I want to go out and do some shopping during my lunch break, which is very normal back in England, so if I have some time, you know, during my lunch break and I need to buy some things, I'll go to the shops and I realize, why are they all closed? Why are all the shops closed? And it's just because the people who work in those shops have just taken their lunch break. In England, normally, those shops would stay open because people work shifts. Some people would eat their lunch early, other people would eat their lunch later, and at least one person would stay in the shop and make sure it was open. And in England, it would be pretty unacceptable if that shop was closed. In France, though, it's okay, because everyone understands, no, we need to eat and enjoy our food. Everyone has the right to just stop working and sit down and eat for those 2 hours. So no one finds it to be a problem that a lot of little shops and things are closed during those 2 hours. Me, on the other hand, sometimes I go out and I think, right, I really need to get, you know, something. And I go to a shop and it's like, why is the shop closed? I can't believe it. And then I realised, ah, no, this is France. They do things a little bit differently here. You just have to accept it. So it could be values. It could be more physical things like the climate and the weather. Just the fact that if you go and live in another country, the air quality might be different, the general temperature, the weather will be different, and it might take you some time to physically adapt to that. If you go back to my episode called Sick in Japan, you can hear a pretty good example of how I wasn't really ready to deal with the very hot and very humid conditions in the Japanese summertime. And I was responding to the hot weather in the same way that I would do back in England, which is basically to go out and get lots of sun on your skin, because you don't get many opportunities to get sunlight. So I was going out getting lots of sunshine, and actually that's kind of dangerous because it's very hot and the sun is very powerful. Naturally, I ended up getting sunburnt, pretty stupid on my part, but I underestimated the power of the heat and the sunlight at that time. Okay, so climate, social systems, language, of course, is massive detail. You know, just being able to understand what the hell is going on around you. All of these things can combine to create a sort of emotional and physical reaction. So what I'm talking to you now about, the four phases of culture shock, is all based on various studies in psychology, sociology, neuroscience, cultural theory, and there is generally accepted knowledge that culture shock impacts in various ways. The four phases, we talk about four phases of it, and some people say that these phases tend to happen within certain periods of time. In my experience, the four phases of culture shock are not always rigidly stuck to time frames. Instead, what I experience is that I might experience different types of culture shock at different times. And sometimes I'm in like phase two, and then at other times I go back to phase one, and then I'm experiencing phase four for a while, then I go back to phase three. It kind of depends on what happens to you while you're living in another place. It depends on events, you know, like people you meet, if you get a girlfriend or boyfriend or something, and that can take you down a certain path. We talk about four phases. It's not necessarily in the perfect chronological order, but there's certainly four types of experience you can have as a culture shock. I'd like to try and avoid making generalizations. It's always good to do that. I'll be talking about my experiences of different cultures, but I'm always aware that you shouldn't generalize too much, and that you've got to try and keep an open mind. But I will just tell you about things that I've experienced myself. If you, listening to this, consider them to be untrue or generalizations, or at least if you get the impression that I don't really understand something about the culture that I'm talking about, that's fine. That's absolutely normal. I'm not an expert on every single place I've visited. I'm just telling you about my experiences. So if you think there's something I need to know that will help not just me, but everyone get a greater understanding of the things I'm talking about, then what are you going to do? Of course, you're going to leave a comment on the website. Go to teacherluke.co.uk, find this episode, and just leave your comments. I'd love to hear from you. Right, so let's get started. Let's talk about the different phases of culture shock, all right? Phase one is called the honeymoon phase. The honeymoon phase. Right, honeymoon. You know what that is, don't you? That's when two people get married. They get married and then immediately they go on their honeymoon. It's a kind of holiday where everything's wonderful and fantastic because you're just married and you're looking at life through rose-tinted spectacles. Rose-tinted glasses means that you're seeing everything in a very romantic and positive light. People often use the word honeymoon to talk about a period of time. It's the honeymoon period. It's the honeymoon phase, meaning the positive period that happens at the start before reality kicks in. Okay, so the honeymoon phase. So in this phase, apparently, any differences between you and the culture you're living in are seen in a kind of romantic and positive light. That's the sort of phase that you experience probably when you go somewhere on holiday. So if you're just sort of vacationing in a place, you're just going on holiday, you're only experiencing the sort of surface, you're only experiencing life in that place, the kind of experience that's been geared or presented to you as a tourist. So of course you're going to have more fun because you're there for fun. There's a whole infrastructure probably in that place designed to make it easier for you as a tourist, so that you don't have to confront all the difficult things that might happen to you on a daily basis if you just live there. No, instead you have tourist agents, you have guidebooks, you have all the stuff that you need to help you have a really good holiday. So yeah, the first few weeks, it's just great. It's like you're on holiday, and everything's really positive. Like, for example, let's see, when I first arrived in Paris, there was a sort of honeymoon period where I was just really buzzing from being in a new place and just finding out all of these weird new experiences. There's something quite exciting about being in a place that you don't know, a place that's got so much to offer. There's all these things that you see. It's all coming in at you at speed, and it's quite overwhelming in a nice way. You know, it's almost like you're in a sort of dream. You're in a dream world, and that's great. It's always good to be, for example, if you go to a new place, to find a nice place to have a drink or to eat something, and you settle down and you have your drink and you just have a look at the way people live their lives in this place, and it's quite almost makes you feel drunk on the experience. I'm going to try and remember that word. I can't. That's terrible, isn't it? You're listening to Luke's English podcast and Luke can't remember a word, but it happens, ladies and gentlemen. It happens to everyone. Doesn't matter if it's your first language or second language. Everyone forgets words at times. No, that word is not going to come to me. Never mind. So I think actually that there is a phase that happens before the honeymoon phase. Not always, but it's possible. And that first phase is just fear and panic. You might know what I'm talking about if you've been somewhere for the first time, maybe on your own. Let's see. Like when I went to Japan, obviously I fluctuated between the honeymoon phase and the kind of fear phase, to be honest with you. I went there on my own, and when I arrived, like the first week or so, it was really up and down. Sometimes it was just really exciting and exhilarating, and other times it was just scary because I thought, well, I don't know what's going on. Like, I don't know if I'm going to get on the wrong bus and I'll end up in a part of the city that I don't know where, you know, I'm scared I'm going to get lost. What happens if I have an accident? It is pretty scary. And at times you just want to stay at home, stay in your safety zone, because you don't want to go out and have to face this radically different world. So I think there is a kind of another first phase, which is that fear when you feel shell-shocked. Shell-shocked, that's an expression that comes from World War One, when bombs dropped around the soldiers, and when a bomb drops near you, it can really disorientate you, and some soldiers would experience something called shell shock. That's where bombs had dropped around them and they get really disorientated and they don't know where they are or what's going on. So it can feel a bit like you're shell shocked at the beginning of your experience. But also the honeymoon phase, very positive, very nice and very romantic. Then we have the negotiation phase. And this is after you've spent time in a place and you've gone through the romantic period and it's not quite so new and exciting anymore. Instead, reality is starting to kick in. And this is when differences between you and the other culture become a lot more obvious and become quite problematic as well. For example, it could result in feelings of frustration or anger. Certain kind of unfavorable things can make you feel like the host culture is actually strange and offensive to you almost. It's the point where you think, okay, this has been really fun, but now I need to get down to business. I need to do some serious things, and then you start to experience some obstacles and barriers. Okay, normally this phase will be brought on by some bad experiences that you might have that kind of bring you back down to earth. Okay, so it could be. It could be something like making honeymoon phase, you make some friends. You make friends with some local people, for example, because you're enjoying kind of exploring their differences, and they're enjoying exploring, you know, the differences that you have between you and them. And, you know, you have all the sort of fun conversations where you say, oh, it's like this in my country, what's it like there? And that's all very fun. And then once you get beyond that and you have to get down to the nitty gritty of a relationship, let's say you're in a relationship, you've got a girlfriend or boyfriend from the culture that you're living in, and something goes wrong, you know, maybe you break up with each other because you realize after a while that actually you don't really understand each other. And the fun of exploring your differences moves into a period where the differences are actually preventing you from being able to operate as a couple, right? So, I mean, I've had that experience when I was in Japan. I did have a girlfriend, and I had, as I just said, it was great at the beginning because you know you're both totally different and sort of exotic and so on, and she's got ideas about you. She's kind of projecting her expectations of you as a foreigner onto you. And maybe you're doing the same thing to her. And then when she realizes that you're not that guy, then it can break down and you have a slightly bad experience. So, yeah, I had a girlfriend in Japan after a few months, and exactly that. I think she probably thought I was going to be like this. She thought I was just different. For some reason, in Japan, they seem to think that if you're a foreigner, that there's something cool about that. I know that not everyone thinks that, but a lot of Japanese people, and people in other countries too, they objectify foreigners to an extent, certainly Westerners, I felt. So, for example, I would meet a group of Japanese people and they would say things like, oh, you're so cool because you're English. And I would think, inside I was thinking, well, no, I'm really not. You know, I'm not that cool at all. Obviously now, listeners, I've obviously become cool. I've become cooler. But I remember when I was in Japan, I didn't really consider myself to be a cool person. I don't really consider myself to be a cool person now, actually. But I just felt I was being treated like I was more special than I deserved. Okay. So people would expect me to be this cool British foreigner. And inside I felt awkward and geeky and not really very confident or cool. I'd never been considered cool really before, but then in Japan suddenly I'm this guy with all this charisma. Maybe the girl that I was seeing had this objectified idea of what I was. I don't really know what she thought I was. But she was certainly excited to be going out with an English guy. But then after a while, when my behavior sort of didn't quite match what she expected of me, maybe it's because maybe it's a question of expectation and reality in many ways. Like, she may have expected me to be cool in some way, but then my real foreign behavior started happening, she didn't really know how to handle it. So I didn't behave in a, I guess, oh, it's difficult to explain, but I guess what might have been going on is that she probably expected me to be cool in a Japanese kind of way. She probably expected me to behave basically like a Japanese person, but a Japanese person who looked like an English guy. Do you know what I mean? So when I started to not behave in that way, it may have caused problems. I don't mean to... Okay, if I'm getting anything wrong, let me know. But I felt like... Okay, in a relationship in England or in the UK, I think it's quite normal to like talk about your feelings quite a lot. We're quite open with our feelings and we talk quite frankly and sincerely in an intimate relationship, we're quite used to exploring our emotions and talking about how things are between you and the girl, right? So it might be that you might have an argument, and it's normal to have an argument where you challenge each other and you get upset with each other, and that's normal. And then after a while, you make up with each other, and you kind of move on, and it helps to strengthen the relationship. I found in Japan, when I started to talk about my feelings, it was a little bit too intense. And it didn't work out. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say, isn't it? Because it could have been a cultural difference between me and the girl, but it could have just been a personality difference, because I could actually say the same thing about relationships I've had with English girls, where after a few months it doesn't work out. So it's very hard to tell, really, if it's just a cultural difference, or if in fact it's just individual differences. Anyway, something like having a breakup will bring you back down to earth, okay? And so at that point, it can make you feel kind of disconnected from the culture you're living in. It doesn't have to be a relationship problem. It could be anything else. It could be, for example, where now that you're living in that country and you need to find a job, and you have to go through all the process of applying for jobs and having interviews in a foreign country, and you realize suddenly that it's different, the rules are different, and it's difficult because you're struggling to adapt to that situation. And you think, I'm good, I can get a job, I'm really good, but these people just don't seem to be able to identify it. Maybe because they're looking for different kinds of skills, they're looking for someone who will present themselves in a different way. I mean, in France, for example, I've realized now that you have to be really well-dressed. And if you're well-dressed, certainly in Paris, if you're well-dressed, it opens doors. Like the other day, I had a job interview, and I wore a really nice suit. I've got one really nice suit, and I thought, I'm going to wear the good suit today and see what happens. I went in the morning to my French class wearing the suit. The teacher was absolutely delighted to see me in a suit. She was just falling over herself with compliments. Oh, you look so elegant. And she kept saying this, and I was like, oh, thanks very much. Maybe the teacher was just being positive to me, because that's what, you know, language teachers do. But I certainly felt a big difference from her. And then I went and had lunch in a restaurant. And normally in restaurants, when I go, I'm like wearing jeans and, you know, like a jacket or something. Here I was really well dressed. And immediately I got the sense the waiter was like really looking after me. He kept kind of making sure I was okay, and you know, giving me lots of attention. And I thought, I'm sure I wouldn't get this kind of treatment if I wasn't wearing this suit. So it seems that being well-dressed in this city is an advantage. And I hadn't really considered that before, because in England, of course, it's important to be well-dressed. But I sort of think, well, it's more important to just say the right things and to do the right things and to have the right intentions and the right knowledge, and that the appearance is secondary. I think, thinking about it now on reflection, I think it's probably true in England too, that if you dress well, that always helps, doesn't it? But I think it's certainly true in Paris. So yes, the negotiation phase, you become more aware of all the differences, and it can cause you to start questioning the culture you're living in and start challenging it and start thinking that they're all wrong, you know. You've got sort of several responses to that negotiation phase. One of them is that they're all wrong, and that I don't know how these people live like this. The other one is, I'm wrong, I'm lost, I'm an idiot, I'm getting everything wrong. Okay, so let's start with the first one. How can they live like this? That's quite a common question that might pop up in your head. And it will do if you're living in a new place. After a while, eventually, you will start challenging what's going on around you, and you will start thinking, how can these people live like this? It's a phase you go through and you sort of deal with it, but it's very normal. For example, when I was living in Japan, I would observe the extreme working culture that they had. People work very hard and they work very late. They often work overtime without being paid. I felt like people were slaves to their companies. It was almost inhumane, it felt like that. But after a while, I realized, well, that's just the way it is here. And although they do work super hard and it can be very stressful, the principle should be that the company that they're working for sort of looks after them in return by giving them like a nice bonus and by giving them different types of support, different kinds of remuneration like healthcare and all these sorts of things. So although to my English eyes it would look like this is insane, this working environment where everyone's so stressed out and they're married to the company, from the Japanese point of view this is quite normal, and it goes back years and years and years back to a system in which there were large companies that would have very hierarchical structures. Well, certainly large companies that had lots of staff who would work for that company forever. They would work for the company for life, and they were very, very loyal to the company. And this system allowed some Japanese companies to become extremely successful and extremely powerful. It's a very effective business model that the Japanese have. It's an employment model, it's a business model, and it's something that makes Japan a great nation to an extent. So I can kind of see the advantage of having companies that demand loyalty from their staff, because ultimately it makes the company bigger and stronger and more powerful, and then the country is stronger, and so that should have some knock-on effect on the general quality of life in that country. I still struggle to understand, to be honest, how some Japanese company workers can get up really early and get on an incredibly crowded train and travel in squashed conditions to work in a company where their boss demands that they work super hard and then forces them to stay late at the end, and then at the weekend they have to come into work because the boss is coming into work, and they don't get any holiday, and they get 5 paid holidays a year, and even some of those days they have to work. I still struggle to deal with that, but you know, in Japan it's normal, so fine. I think that's changing. I expect there may be younger Japanese people listening to this who are thinking, no, it's not like that anymore. Let me know, leave a comment, even a simple basic comment, just tell me what you think. I've mentioned the shops being closed at lunchtime in France sometimes. If you're living in England, it might just be that you've just become fed up with eating the same dull food every day. So you might just get to a point where you think, I cannot eat any more of this bread. How do these people live like this? How do English people live with this food? I'm going to try and answer that question in my next podcast, actually. And it could be that if you're living in London, you might get completely fed up with a summer that never arrives. The summer that never comes in London. And if you are from, let's say, Spain or Italy, or a place where the sun shines a lot, and you come to live in London and you live there for 12 months, it might affect you physically, because you probably will be used to having a certain amount of sunlight on your skin every day, and it allows your body to produce certain vitamins and things like that, and it does affect your mood. In England, we're more used to having less sunlight, and so we understand just by instinct that when the sun shines, you go outside and you get sun on your skin, you try and get as much sun as you can, or we've just developed other ways of somehow making up for the fact that we're not getting as much sun. So it could just be, I don't know, we take a 2-week holiday in a sunny place, or we compensate for lack of sun by, I don't know, drinking lots of tea or beer or something, I don't know. But there's probably some way in which English people have learnt to deal with lack of sun. Maybe it's just that for some people in England, the skin tone, you know, means that our bodies are slightly more sensitive to sunlight. And so when the sun does shine, we get as much, you know, vitamin D as we can just naturally, just because the skin is more sensitive. There's all sorts of possible ways in which in England, having less sunlight is normal. And in, let's say, the south of Spain, that would be seen as almost like torture. One thing I can say is that in England, we do find it miserable that there's no sunlight. And I say no sunlight. It's not really true, because we do get weeks and weeks and weeks of beautiful sunshine. But it can feel like, you know, at the end of February or the beginning of March, it can feel like you've spent, you know, 6 months without seeing the sun. But we do find that miserable too. We're not all running around going, yay, clouds, we love rain. No, we're not doing that either. We hate that weather too. It's just that maybe we've developed a way of dealing with it. You know, we have that kind of dark sense of humour, which is just a sort of a way of trying not to let things bother you too much. You know, maybe that's where the stiff upper lip character comes from. That kind of sense of, well, yes, it's everything's crap, but I'm not going to let it get me down. Come on, let's stay in control. Don't get too emotional. Don't get too upset. Maybe that's something to do with it. Right. So, yeah, it can be largely environmental, dealing with weather changes, light cycles are different, bacteria levels, you know, just generally. In a new place, you might find that the balance of bacteria is different and your immune system isn't really able to deal with it as well. So you might get sick a little bit at the beginning and it takes a while for your immune system to catch up. It could be that the water has a different sort of chemical balance to it. In London, the water is very hard. It has lots of let's see, it's got lime in it. For example, when you make lots of cups of tea, if you look inside your kettle, in London, you'll find that the kettle will be caked with a sort of mineral. And that's normal. It's just our water is hard. And this affects, for example, people's hair. So a lot of the girls who I used to teach in London, it was quite regular complaints. They would talk about the hair. Like, I don't know what it is about the water in this country, but my hair it's really bad for my hair. So back in their own country, they've got beautiful flowing hair, and then they come to London for a few months and the hair is like suffering from the different water. Whereas, you know, the English girls, it's kind of normal and the hair has adapted to it. It could be different medical practices, different food packages and availability. So those things can make you feel like the place you're living in is wrong and ridiculous. And that's a perfectly normal thing to experience. You just have to try and be aware that it's happening. I've spoken before about the fact that culture shock isn't really a good expression, and that we should perhaps say things like culture depression or culture frustration. So what can happen is that you tend to just find that you're having a frustrating or confusing or even upsetting time. You might feel lonely, you might feel homesick, and it doesn't mean it's just you. They're completely normal, completely natural responses to a change in environment. So what you shouldn't do is start to build up attitudes about the place that you're living in. You should try not to assume that the place you're living in is all wrong, because there will be perfectly good reasons behind everything. So what you should avoid is making... you should avoid making up your mind about the place that you're living in. And I mean, you should avoid collecting various negative points of view. It's a trap, okay? It's a trap. Don't start complaining about the place that you live in all the time, because it's just going to make you look like a miserable person. You need to be open-minded. You need to accept that things are just different, and you need to try and learn to enjoy them as well, and accept that, okay, I'm having a difficult time, but it could just be me because I'm trying to adapt to a different lifestyle. It could be that. And similarly, don't feel too bad about yourself either. You might feel like, I'm an idiot because I'm getting everything wrong. I keep making mistakes. I feel like I'm the odd one out. I feel alienated. Again, try not to feel lonely or alienated too much. It's completely natural. You're just not used to living in that place. So you need to make an effort to be positive. You need to try and remain social. Don't stay inside. Don't hide. Don't hide away at home. You need to, in that situation, that's when you need to reach out to people, make friends with others, try to make friends with the locals if you can, but bear in mind that there are obstacles and barriers between you, and that if you're both aware of those things, it can be a great way to overcome those things. So be positive, be social, don't let it get you down. Remember that there's always a good reason for things being different, and just keep going and enjoy it. Okay, enjoy the differences, celebrate the differences, I would say. There's also a fear in the negotiation stage. For me, there's a fear that you're being converted and that you're losing your real self. And that's quite a common fear. The idea that, okay, I've been living here for 6 months and I can feel that I'm becoming different. I'm changing. I'm becoming English, or I'm becoming French, or I'm becoming Japanese. And that can be quite a scary moment too, because you think, I'm losing myself. I'm losing who I really am. I'm losing my identity. I'm being converted. That's a normal fear as well. Let's see. Massive language barriers. The language barriers. Now, you might even think that you're quite good in the language. So if you're going to live in Scotland, for example, you might think, well, my English is actually pretty good. Well, be careful, because you may have just learnt a certain type of English. You may have learnt English to what you believe to be a good standard based on the requirements in your country. Like your teacher in your country has said that you're advanced, but when you get to Scotland, you realise that you're far from advanced because you can't understand anything they're saying. Obviously, in Scotland, they have an accent, but there you go. There's a language barrier, which can mean that subtleties in communication, like you miss a lot of the subtleties, you miss the nuances and small details in the language. And as a result, you're only getting a kind of basic half understanding of what people are saying around you. And the danger there is that you start to come to false conclusions about the people. Okay. Now, from my experience living in Paris, I don't speak French very well. I'm learning. I'm taking classes at the moment. Hope to tell you more about that on a podcast soon. We're still recording. Good. I thought we'd stop recording for a second, but no, we're still going. So I'm living in Paris and my French is not very good. And so when I'm with French people, I'm listening to them. Obviously, I can't understand everything they're saying. And so what I miss is the sense of humour. OK, I hardly ever get jokes in French. Now, this could mean one of two things. It could mean French people or Parisian people have no sense of humour. It could mean that. It could mean that they're not funny, they don't make jokes, and they just complain about everything all the time. It could mean that, or it could just mean that my French is not good enough to be able to identify the jokes, and that it might look like they're just complaining. What they're actually doing is making lots of very clever, very dark, very ironic jokes, very deadpan jokes about everything. And in fact, the French have got an extremely well-developed and very subtle and very dark sense of humour, just like the English people do. So, you know, don't fall into the first trap. You have to realise that, no, give these people credit. I'm sure that they couldn't just exist without a sense of humour. How could anyone exist without a sense of humour? Of course they do. It's just, it's got a different rhythm and the words are subtle, and so you might not understand them. So avoid coming to false conclusions about the people around you. Okay, for example, don't assume they have no sense of humour. It's just that you're not able to identify it. Also, body language too. Body language is a thing that you might not be aware of, that in your country, body language is almost subconscious. People are communicating massive messages just by their body movements and the way that they stand, the way they look at you, eye contact, personal space and things like that. So it's quite possible to completely misunderstand just because you're not aware of the body language conventions in that place. For example, going to Japan, you might think that, you know, you might assume that all Japanese people like you because they're laughing at everything you say. So, for example, there was a girl who used to work in my school, and I used to say good morning to her, and she would laugh. Like, ha-ha, good morning. And I used to think, wow, I am so funny. Even the way I say good morning is hilarious. And I can make these girls laugh just by saying good morning. I'm brilliant. Well, no, that's not really what was going on. What really was going on is that she was laughing because she was shy and nervous and maybe a bit uncomfortable because she probably was shy about speaking English. And so it's not that you're brilliant. It's just that she is feeling awkward about trying to speak English in front of you. There is an idea, there is a phenomenon called the charisma man in Japan. And I'd like to talk to you about this again in a later episode. The charisma man is a man who, in his home country, he's boring and he's not very popular with girls, and he's just a sort of ordinary person. But inside, he would love to one day become a famous celebrity. It's just that he's not very attractive. He doesn't have a particularly outstanding personality. There's nothing very engaging about him. And then he goes to Japan. And immediately all these girls are laughing at everything he says and they're treating him like a celebrity. And it goes to his head because he doesn't have the perspective to realize that it's just a cultural thing. Instead, it goes directly to his head and he starts walking around like he thinks he's God's gift to the Japanese. And this is a really common phenomenon among expats living in Japan, and most people are aware of it, but some people aren't. The idea of the charisma man. So in his home country, he's just a boring, ordinary person. But then when he goes to Japan, he becomes charisma man. And even the enemy of charisma man as well is the Western woman. Because with the Japanese girls, he's like super popular, super charismatic movie star. And then he meets an American girl, and immediately he just transforms back to being boring, uninteresting and geeky just because she, she sees him in a completely different way. Interesting, isn't it? Interesting. There can be positive things that you can get from living abroad and negative things too. And I think it's important to be aware of both so that, for example, if you're being treated differently, you don't start to let it get, you don't let it go to your head. You don't let it make you become arrogant. Yes, body language, for example, is important. All these things can be exacerbated by your age. For example, when you go and live abroad for the first time, it's probably if you're young, and so you're not so experienced and you're not so well equipped to deal with these differences. Right, now the third phase is adjustment. That's when you adjust to life in that different country. So you develop a kind of an effective routine that works for you. You develop problem-solving skills. You develop strategies for dealing with the differences. The culture is not so different anymore. It's become normal for you. In fact, you may have developed a deeper understanding of the culture, which allows it all to make more sense. You've developed an appreciation of the culture that you're living in. It might, again, make you feel a bit scared sometimes because you feel you're being cut off from your roots and you're losing something about your original culture. But certainly you're able to operate properly because you understand what's going on, right? For example, learning to adopt a more French approach to life, for me, which would be learning to deal with being direct. In England, generally, we're quite indirect. We don't like to say exactly how we feel unless we're in a relationship of trust, unless we're with our friends or people we trust very closely. If it's just sort of people we don't know that well, acquaintances or work colleagues, we will probably try and be indirect to prevent any conflicts that would be uncomfortable and awkward for us. We don't like getting into disagreements. We find it upsetting and uncomfortable. We don't like to have confrontations with people on public transport or in the street. We find it to be embarrassing and uncomfortable and awkward. Now, in France, for example, people are a lot more direct, and so they will quite comfortably tell people how they feel. They'll give their opinions. They wear their attitudes on their sleeves. And it's quite normal to be very direct and to maybe even get into a little argument with someone that you don't know. And then after you've done that, then things tend to get a bit better. But in England, it's kind of awkward and uncomfortable to be so direct. But if you live like that in France, in this culture, if I lived with this English frame of mind all the time, then life would just be too difficult and too exhausting. So what happens is I've learned to adopt a slightly more French approach. I mean, I'm not, you know, French by any means. I never will be. Even if I get, you know, French citizenship or something, I'm still going to be Luke from Luke's English Podcast. But, you know, you learn to just sort of relax, to argue with people, to tell people how you feel. Don't be worried about causing a fuss. You know, you just learn to adapt. And that's great because it's healthier. You've got to do as the, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do. You know that phrase? So when in Paris, you try and behave in the normal way there, because it's better to go with the flow than to try and resist. To an extent, you don't have to just change completely, but you can just learn to go with the flow a little bit. What you can realize during this adjustment phase is instead of thinking these people are ridiculous, how can people live like this, you suddenly realize, oh right, actually these people are really clever. You know, when you realize that their system works for them, then that's brilliant, because you think, wow, actually the French are much more intelligent than I expected, or they've got their lifestyle fixed. They know exactly how to live and it works. For example, it's great in France. At 5 o'clock, you leave the office. Not every time. Some people, like lawyers, for example, will work late. A lot of people work overtime. But generally, the culture seems to be that at 5 o'clock, you finish. And that can be annoying for me with my English brain, with my English head, because I think I can send an email to someone in an office at 5:30 and I can expect a reply the same day. But no, it doesn't work like that. You send an email to someone after 5 o'clock, you're not going to get a reply until the next day. And so that can be frustrating. But then you kind of think, well, actually, if I'm working here, that's great, because it means I can finish work at 5 and then I get my life back. So the system works for them. It's different, but it works too. Let's see. The outcomes. Now, there are various outcomes to the negotiation or adjustment phases. Actually, wait a minute. Let me go on to the fourth phase next, and that is mastery. That it's called mastery. That's where you become a master of your world. When someone has become a master, that person can operate without any problems. Sometimes it's called bicultural. You become bicultural. It means that you can operate perfectly in both cultures, and that's pretty cool, because people like that are usually a lot more open-minded. So that's where you're able to shift between different cultural mindsets, different lifestyles. So, for example, if I go back to London, hopefully I can just shift back into the London frame of mind and start operating like a Londoner, doing all the normal London things. And then coming back to Paris, you adapt and you are able to do all the right Parisian things too. And these people, these sort of cultural masters, are pretty cool, because it means that they have the whole world, you know, the whole world is their oyster, because they learn to adapt based on where they are. And I find people like that tend to be pretty cool. You know, when you meet someone who has experience of living in different cultures, and they've got an open mind, and they've got they've got patience with cultural difference, those people are the coolest ones. They're the ones who stay positive and they don't get upset. So they don't get pissed off about differences, and they're just cool. So that's good. The master cultural mastery, the best of both worlds. Okay, that's where they also learn how to get the best out of both situations. So they learn, I mean, using London and France, you know, Paris and France, what am I saying? Paris and London as an example, they learn, for example, how to cook like the Parisians, but they learn how to, how to be polite to each other on public transport like the Londoners. So in an ideal world, you'd get like the same public transport etiquette in London, but with the food from Paris. That's a bit of a generalization, because in fact, some people on the underground in London can be really inconsiderate, and some food in England can be delicious too. So you've got to be careful. I think part of this mastery is also accepting that, yes, there are some cultural conventions, but you also have to know when to just reject all those cultural stereotypes and just treat everyone as a human being, and give the, treat them with patience, and assume on the positive side, like assume that these people are clever and reasonable people, instead of having some conflict and assuming that they're all stupid idiots. I mean, that's obviously a terrible thing to do. Right now, there are, in terms of outcomes or responses to culture shock, there are kind of three directions that you can go in. The first one, in my opinion, is the worst direction that you can go in when faced with culture shock. And this is to just reject it. These are the rejectors. Okay, so imagine someone who's gone to live, let's say, in the UK for a year, and they experience the adjustment period, they experience some barriers and problems, and what do they do? They just reject the culture that they're facing, and they become isolated, they're unable to integrate with the culture. They live in their own communities, so they just spend time with people from their countries and they speak their own language. They have, you know, lots and lots of bad experience with the local people, and they tend to think that the local culture is hostile and separate, and that there's a difference between them and the locals, and they might start to develop these weird misconceptions about the local culture, assuming that it's wrong or stupid or whatever. And often these people don't even realize it's happening. That's why it's so important to be aware of culture shock when it happens, because it allows you to deal with it. Often the people who reject the culture that they've lived in don't even realize that they're experiencing culture shock. They're so unaware, they're so narrow-minded, that they just assume that everything that's happening around them is just wrong, and that it's incredibly arrogant, don't you think, to go and live in another country and to just assume that the way that people live their lives in that country is wrong. I mean, it is arrogant, but I have to admit that we all experience that to an extent. I experience it. I do. I have to admit it. Living in France, I do experience that sense of like frustration when coming face to face with certain things in French culture that I don't understand, like the queuing etiquette, which I've talked about before. In England, we have a regimented queuing system. People naturally, subconsciously, will stand close to the person in front of them in the queue, and people are very aware of their position. In France, it seems to be a little bit more relaxed, and people might jump ahead of you in the queue if you're not watching out. And that gets to me every time. I can't stand being queue jumped. It's a real issue for me. But I always have to think to myself, it's okay, just don't get too upset about it. Instead, what I do is I remember it, write it down, and then use it in stand-up comedy and just make fun of the situation. That seems to be a really good way of dealing with it. Sense of humor is so important. Ironically, these rejectors have more problems integrating back into their home culture because they've changed without realizing it, and then they find it extremely hard to deal with. So it's like these people just have no idea what's going on. All that's happening is that they're resisting change, but they don't realize that change is inevitable, and that they can't stop it. So even when they go back to their own countries, they don't realize that they've changed, and so they experience the same culture shock again, and they're unable to deal with it again because they're kind of in denial. Right, another one, another direction that you can go in when you live abroad is to just completely adopt the culture that you're living in. So these people are called adopters. So we've had rejectors and now adopters. So the adopters basically integrate fully, just become fully integrated. They might even lose their original identity. For example, they would sort of stop speaking their first language. They would start becoming kind of proud of the host culture that they're living in, start supporting the national football team, for example. These are the sorts of people that would probably live in the country forever. They might be, they might have emigrated. So you find that, for example, a lot of the Indian community who came to live in England, they actually decided, they made a conscious decision to start speaking English at home, because they did it out of respect for the country they were living in, and they thought that ultimately, since they were living in the UK, that they would speak English and they would live like English people. I'm not saying it's good or bad, it's just one of the options. Then the thing about the Indian families, not all Indian families, and it wasn't just Indian families, not all Indian families like stopped speaking their native language. A lot of Indian families kind of have both, and they become very cosmopolitan, and they are still completely in touch with their original Indian roots, and yet they also have the English and the understanding of the English culture. So I suppose this is like the third direction that you can go in. You can become a cosmopolitan master, which is where you learn to adapt and to be flexible, moving between cultures, creating a unique blend of the best of both worlds. That's what I said before about being like a superhero, international man. You can take the positive aspects of both cultures and remain open-minded and have a tolerant and flexible attitude to change. These kinds of people can become quite nomadic, though, as moving, changing, learning to adapt in different countries, that becomes the norm. And so they end up unable to settle down, and they have to keep moving. They get itchy feet after a few years, and they have to have the buzz and the excitement of moving to a different culture. So these kind of cosmopolitan people can be quite nomadic. You know, you find that they just never stay settled in one place for too long, and after a couple of years they're off and living somewhere else. It's quite common for English language teachers to be fairly nomadic, just because they have the option of living in other countries. Yes, so there we go. We've had four phases of culture shock. We had the first phase was the honeymoon phase, possibly accompanied by a fear and panic phase. We had the negotiation phase. We had the what was the other phase? The negotiation phase. We had the adjustment phase, the mastery phase as well. Those are the four phases. Then different outcomes. Either people become rejectors because they don't even realize that they are rejecting the culture that they're living in. They might become adopters and just become fully converted, or they might become these kind of cool cosmopolitan masters, these sort of superheroes of the world, these international people. There is a final thing I want to talk about, and that's reverse culture shock. Reverse culture shock is when you've been living abroad and you come back to your own country and you experience culture shock coming back. Now, this is always a surprise, and it can be more difficult. It can be even more difficult than the first round of culture shock, because no one realizes you're different. You see, they don't realize that you've changed. So no one realizes you're different. No one treats you differently. And it's somehow kind of more disturbing. It seems like, doesn't anyone realize that I'm different? And everyone treats you like you used to be, but they can't see the things that have changed about you. It can be cool because it allows you to rediscover your own culture with fresh eyes, with a fresh perspective. But it can also be quite tough to try and deal with the re-entry into your own culture. I'll try and give you an example of Japan. So you know that when I first arrived, it was really complicated because I was scared of getting on the wrong bus. I didn't know how to use cash machines. Just everything I did was complicated and difficult, and so it was quite scary. But accompanied with that was this incredible, invigorating excitement of like investigating a new culture and all of the fun things that come along with that. Then sort of reality set in when I sort of had trouble with a relationship and when I struggled to do other things like deal with having to pay bills and like dealing with doctor's appointments and a medical situation and getting sick. And then after that, I felt like I understood the culture in a lot more depth and I became a lot more sophisticated about how to live in Japan. I got a more sincere appreciation of the Japanese lifestyle. I started to live a bit more like the Japanese. For example, it's hard to say some of the things. Okay, one thing is that I learned that taking your shoes off before you come home, before you come into your apartment, is a really good thing because it keeps the floor clean and it feels like everywhere you go on the floor is all clean and you can sit on the floor and it's not kind of dirty or anything. The place is so much cleaner and more comfortable and pleasant when you take your shoes off at the door. And so that became normal for me. And after I moved back to London, I lived in an apartment in London for about 6 months, and then my brother moved in with me. Now, I was still living like a Japanese person to an extent, living in a sort of peaceful, fairly quiet way, taking my shoes off, just living with a sort of Japanese sensibility. I like to keep things clean and tidy. And then my brother came back, and it was just like a little culture clash, but he didn't realize because he had no idea of the culture that I was coming back from. So he thought I was just me as I was before. And so he found it really strange and weird that I was asking him to take his shoes off before he came in. And it was difficult for me because I didn't want to force him to do it, but I thought it was good. And I believed that if I could convince him to take his shoes off every day, that he'd also start to appreciate the fact that it would be cleaner and more comfortable. I mean, like, I never realized until I'd lived in Japan for several years that wearing your shoes around the house when you've got carpet all over the floor is kind of disgusting. Because if you think about it, that carpet must get really filthy and horrible. Now, a lot of people who come to live in England have this complaint. Like, they say, I can't believe you've got carpet everywhere, it's disgusting. And I do understand that completely. The carpet must get very dirty, especially when you're wearing shoes that you've been wearing outside in the street, and you're just walking in the street, and then you're walking on your carpet with the same shoes. It's horrible when you think about it. But growing up in England, where we had carpet on the floor all the time, it was completely normal. And to be honest with you, I don't think we ever suffered that much from, you know, we weren't getting all ill and sick all the time from having dirty carpets. Maybe a lot of it's in the mind, and that it's, you know, the dirt that you get on the carpet is fairly harmless. But I didn't realize, and it wasn't until I'd lived in Japan that I started to think, actually, carpet's a bit disgusting, and wearing shoes on carpet is also pretty disgusting. But my brother had no clue about any of this. And so for him, he just felt like I was being really annoying, asking him to take his shoes off. So that really there was nothing I could do, because I would say to him, James, do you think you could take your shoes off? And he would get all annoyed, like, oh, I don't want to take my shoes off, like that. And then it would be a bit of a problem, you know. So there are lots of things like that, and all kinds of other things I could go into. I'm not going to go into it now because I'm running out of time. So reverse culture shock. Okay, so there you go. That's my episode about the stages of culture shock. I hope that you found it useful. If you have something to say, you know what to do, teacherluke.co.uk. Go there and write some comments. Share your culture shock experiences. I'd very much like to know about them. Do you agree with the four stages? Do you think there are four? Are there any other stages? What experiences have you had that match those stages? Tell me, what culture shock experiences have you had? Where did you go? What happened? Tell me. Just give me a basic comment, simple, a few lines if you want, or you can tell me more. whatever you want to do, I'm interested in reading about your experiences. That's it for this episode. If you're listening in Russia, hello. If you're listening in Poland, Spain, Italy, the UK, Japan, Ukraine, United States, Republic of South Korea, Brazil, Czech Republic, Belarus, or Mexico, hello to you. You were my top countries yesterday. I know that I get listened to in other places. If your country's not on that list, you know what to do. Tell your friends about Luke's English Podcast so you can get your country up to the top of that list. All right, that's it for this episode. Speak to you very soon. But for now, it's goodbye. Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, you can visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.